My name is Jonathan Frerichs. I'm a missionary of the ELCA in the Middle East. Last week we were serious. This week we're going to be less serious. We spoke about the Middle East last week. This week we talk about some mountain stories because everybody has their hobbies, and as I've been overseas in various places as a missionary, I've been especially happy when the Holy Spirit has included a few mountain ranges in the vicinity of what I do. And the heart of tonight's session revolves around a long weekend squeezed in between some work in East Africa. I'd like to talk a little bit about the mountain of Kilimanjaro, which I think you all know is in the country of Tanzania, a little bit about its history from the point of view of those we know about only because they climbed it or they had something to do with its discovery, quote unquote, and then refer to the climbing of it and the kind of characters one finds on it on any sort of day that you might choose to go there. A sort of a James Michener beginning for this could be that as modern geology, which I know next to nothing about, took shape, Don Ring isn't here anymore, I believe. He was a geologist here last week. But as it took shape about 150 years ago, the notion that the Earth was a self-perpetuating entity, a developing entity, that notion was discovered or ascertained, and the feeling became academic that the continents arose out of the internal heat of the Earth, and they were pushed up to their shape that we know them, and the rest of the time was erosion beating them back. And if you like, there's two elements in there who have an opposed function in geology. On the one hand, fire, the builder of continents, the builder of mountains, and on the other hand, ice, the destroyer, the breaker down, ice in the form of water or in the form of glaciers, which we know a little bit around here. So to Kilimanjaro with the words fire and ice in your mind, perhaps. And if we take a map of Africa, very roughly, if you'll accept that as Africa, there's a lake here, which we still call Lake Victoria, I believe. Have they renamed it? It says something about what we're talking about tonight right away. And about here, between the coast and Lake Victoria, is Kilimanjaro. Okay? Now, keep that in your mind. Is everybody relatively familiar where this is? There's Tanzania, here's Kenya, here's Somalia, here's Ethiopia, here's Egypt, here's Sudan. Okay?
Where's the
equator? The equator is basically right through it. Kilimanjaro is, I think, 2 degrees or 1 degree or 3 degrees from the equator. So, if you went to this part of the world and had a look, this is sort of what you would see. The typical view is from the Tanzanian side, from the south, because the border with Kenya and Tanzania is right there on the northern slopes of the mountain. But you'd see something like this. And I need more space, and if Holden didn't mind, we could draw this line out here down to about there. Okay? Holden minds? I'd just like to put a few of the things that belong on this picture as we look at it. First of all, the top, in good Western fashion, let's be goal-oriented. The top is here at 19,340 feet. But it's not in feet, it's in meters. It's 5,895 meters. I mean, that's the way it's known around the world. The top of this little bump, this is the top of Kilimanjaro, and it's known as Uhuru Peak ever since the independence of Tanzania. The top of this little bump is 17,564. So no small mountain by its, in its own right. This thing, which is called Mawenzi. And you'll see it from various angles. It's one of the most photogenic items on the mountain. It's a volcano. This is a volcano. That's a volcano. There's an extinct volcano in between here that I won't draw. It's also worth mentioning that this is in a pretty flat place. There's another mountain over here called Meru, if any of you have been to Moshi or Arusha in Tanzania, northern Tanzania. But apart from that mountain and this group, this huge mountain, the country is pretty flat. And it's worth noting that the distance from here to that place out on Holden's screen that we can't mark is something like 70 miles. So we're talking about an enormous sand pile, an enormous mound sticking up out of a fairly flat place. And it's about 30 miles this way. So you have a long distance. The distance between the top of the crater here and Mawenzi, this place is called the Saddle, and you'll see several pictures from that area. That's 7 miles. And inside here, let's change colors, is a cone, a caldera, with a volcanic cone in it. It's more flat like this. It's about 1,000 feet deep, and it's about over a mile, I think it's 1.2 miles wide. The volcanic cone, or crater rather, with a caldera, the caldera being the crater and the cone being the smaller rise inside the top of the mountain. And the town you might have heard about is Moshi, down here on the flatland. It's sort of the place from which one climbs, goes first before going up to try to climb. And there's another famous town here, which some of you may know. Both of these are great Lutheran towns, by the way. Arusha and Moshi, strong diocese and strong bishops of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania, which is why I was working there briefly in 1986. Now, that's the mountain in very, very brief strokes. I forgot one thing, which you'll see later. I should add it before I go on. There are distinct zones to the, especially the flora, as you go up. As you know, going up a mountain is very similar to going north towards the North Pole. And you see these zones very clearly on Kilimanjaro. Below 5,000 feet, so let's just put it in here somewhere, say 5,000 feet is at this line. This is sort of typical East African scrubland, the kind of country where you see giraffes and antelopes and things running around. The next band is up to 9,000 feet, and this is called cloud forest. It looks a lot like rainforest, but it's not quite as thick, and it's covered in cloud a fair bit of the time. Fairly dense cloud forest up to 9,000 feet. Above that, you've got a zone which they call moorland. I think of it almost as tundra, alpine scrub, alpine tundra, but I think moorland is what the books say. And that goes up to about 13,500. And then the scrubs get thinner and thinner and drier and farther apart and more brittle. And you just wonder how anything can live. And then you're into a zone called alpine desert. And then the alpine desert runs out at about 17,000. It doesn't really run out because it keeps going. And at 17,000, you've got ice cap. Plus what was probably just more of the desert, but it's sort of fun to think of it as, you know, lunar landscape, because that's how it seems. There's just about hardly anything you can spot that has any kind of life in it at that altitude. Now a word about the history. And this is history of the awareness of Kilimanjaro. It's not history of the mountain by any means. We're talking as Europeans, especially European awareness of the mountain, the kind of awareness that leads us to put discovery into our books. And you can go into the Encyclopedia Britannica and read it, but read when this mountain was discovered. And you'll hear about it right now. It was referred to, but not discovered, by the ancient Greeks. They talked about snow-covered mountains in Africa. It was referred to by Arabic traders. Arabic traders down the coast, the east coast of Africa here, did a slave trade for about 2,000 years up until the latter decades of the last century. And some of them referred to this snow-covered mountain, and the name Kilimanjaro. Kilima means mountain, and Jaro means caravan. So it's Mountain of the Caravans, mountain from which, by which perhaps slave caravans and trade caravans got their bearings and navigated across these open plains. So the Arabs have a strong claim to perhaps discovering it, if we're not going to give it to the Africans. And then in 1509 is the first European reference. A Spanish geographer, hard on the heels of the Portuguese who held the coast for a while in 1509, referred to this snow-covered mountain inside there, someplace in from the coast. But it really gets serious when the Anglo-Saxons get onto it, and that's in 1845, about 150 years ago. A geographer at the Royal Geographic Society in London, the kind of place you saw in the movie Around the World in 80 Days, you know, where the gentlemen sit there and smoke their pipes and argue about what the world really is like from inside London. He wrote about it, and he called it Kilimanjaro, and he said it was covered in red pebbles right over the top of it, and the red pebbles were the pebbles that the local people used as money. So he was dead sure about that, and he defended that for about 15 or 20 years, that point of view. But it wasn't the explorers or the businessmen or the non-European slave traders who really put it on the map for us, it was the missionaries. So it's nice to be talking about it as a missionary. It's curious to note that these two activities, slavery and mission work, both contribute to our history, our understanding of the mountain. And the missionaries that get that claim happen to be two German missionaries, one German, one Swiss actually, working on British mission society work, the Church Missionary Society out of London. And a man named Ludwig Krapf was one of the chief players here in the middle of the 1800s. He had a vision. He was working on the coast down near Zanzibar, by where Dar es Salaam is today. And he had a vision of a chain of mission stations stretching across Africa from where he was to the west and conquering Africa and making it into a huge Christian continent. And it so happens that his first stage was a little ways in from the coast, and his second stage happened to be in a place that was heavily populated called Chaga. And Chaga are some of the people who to this day and always have lived on the slopes of Kilimanjaro. There's a lot of land and fertility where you can live in this area, the aprons of the mountain. In planning for his trip to this second mission station in his chain that would reach across Africa and conquer the continent for God, he did some research, and he heard from the Africans that there was a mountain that had a silver top. It was full of evil spirits and genies. Gunpowder wouldn't fire on its slopes. When you went up there, your legs stiffened. This is good Holden Village knowledge. And people died from the evil spirits on the mountain. And I'd like us to remember a bit about the gunpowder not firing, the leg stiffening, and people dying when they're up on the mountain. This didn't stop Ludwig Krapf. He went ahead anyway, but he fell sick at the last moment, and his colleague, a Swiss missionary by the name of Johannes Rebmann, went ahead with some African porters in only a small party, and on his way to Chaga, to this what would be the second post in this chain, he was the lucky European to make the first sighting of Kilimanjaro, and he's in the Britannica Encyclopedia as the discoverer of Kilimanjaro in this year of 1848. Here's a bit about his party and a little bit from his diary, the day he made the first sighting, and you'll see a first sighting of the mountain in a minute on the slides. The party lost their way in thorn thickets, slept where tribal wars had been fought before, heard the growling of lions, and were detained for some days in the company of Mina, a regional chief of the Taita people. The people Rebmann encountered were surprised that he carried only an umbrella, where before caravans were obliged to retain the protection of 500 armed men. In reply, Rebmann observed that the Almighty had cleared the way for the diffusion of the gospel. They left Mina's village with a gift of meat that attracted the hyenas. On the 10th of May, they saw zebra, giraffe, and rhinoceros. They passed pits dug to trap elephants and walked through sharp and spiky grass that cut Redmond's feet. They camped that night to the southeast of Ngalia, about 150 kilometers from the coast. Next morning, the 11th of May, 1848, Redmond wrote in his diary, "The mountains of Chaga gradually rose more distinctly to my sight. At about 10 o'clock, I had no watch with me." He was a Swiss, but he never watched with him. "I observed something remarkably white on top of a high mountain, and first supposed that a very white cloud, in which supposition my guide also confirmed me. But having gone a few paces more, I could no more rest satisfied with that explanation. While I was asking my guide a second time whether that white thing was indeed a cloud, and scarcely listening to his answer that yonder was a cloud, but what that white was, he did not know, but supposed it to be coldness. The most delightful recognition took place in my mind of an old, well-known European guest called Snow. All the strange stories we had so often heard about the gold and silver mountain Kilimanjaro and Jaga, supposed to be inaccessible on account of evil spirits which had killed a great many of those who had attempted to ascend it, were now at once rendered intelligible to me, as of course the extreme cold, to which the poor natives were perfect strangers, would soon chill and kill the half-naked visitors. I endeavored to explain to my people the nature of that white thing for which no name exists even in the language of Jaga itself. But they at first appeared as if they were not to trust my word. Soon after we sat down to rest a little, when I read the 111th Psalm at which I had just arrived in my daily reading, it made a singular impression on my mind in the view of the beautiful snow mountain so near the equator, and gave, especially the sixth verse, the best expression to the feelings and anticipations I was moved with. And the sixth verse reads, Psalm 111, He hath shewed his people the power of his works, that he may give them the heritage of the heathen. Well, this appeared in the London Missionary Society magazine a year later, and all the scientists and geographers and adventurers started arguing about whether or not it was possible to have snow on the equator. And this argument went on for 15 years. And it's a little bit like we Europeans just can't believe the world can be different than our own ken, than our own understanding. And we try to fit it into our understanding of the world, like any people will do. But in this case, as if snow was somehow European. Now, you've heard about maybe Sir Richard Burton, not the actor, but the man who had the same name about 100 years ago, the great explorer who found the source of the Nile, the great British imperialist explorer. He was sent to find the Nile in 1857, and he passed to the south of Kilimanjaro. He didn't see it, but he too got reports from the natives, the indigenous people of that region, that about this mountain. And listen again to what they say about the mountain, that there were fiery beings high on the mountain, that it was intensely cold, that the top of this mountain receded as you approached it. Have any of you had that experience on your way to Holden Lake? That the summit rose as you ascended towards it. That blood would burst from your nostrils suddenly. That your fingers would bend backwards. I'm not sure what that means. And that all who tried it were forced back. Some more African, the only African commentary we tend to get on our books about Kilimanjaro, these kinds of things. Well, European contacts continued. There was a German nobleman who climbed a little bit and spent 19 days in 1861 and came back in 1863 and claims he went to about 4,200 meters, which would be about in here, and claims he was turned back by the snow, but it's not verified. There was a Britisher in the 1870s who decided that Africa would never be civilized by the Europeans because they were all dying of malaria and fever down on the coast. And what they needed to do was to come and settle here on the flanks of this mountain in this fertile Jaga country and be healthy so they could civilize Africa. And he proposed this to the Foreign Office in London. They didn't reply to him. Another Britisher in the 1880s set up a chicken farm and a vegetable farm. He grew the kind of things that are on the Holden menu. He wrote letters to England about it and said, this place is the size of Switzerland. It could raise a great amount of produce. All we need is settlers. We'll give them the land free. Okay? Nothing happened. But now, let's go. Well, I just add one more thing. It ended up in German hands. And so we've had one German already. And then the people who actually climb it for the first time are also Germans. It ended up in German hands by a bit of a swap between the Germans and the British. The British had claims to the area, but they ended up giving it to the Germans because they didn't want any more trouble with them than they already had. And the local authorities were bypassed, and it ended up as a German colony in 1885. Now, as we look at some slides of it, I'd like you to remember the contrast between the outsiders sort of squabbling and scheming to take over the place and arguing it with reality and with reports from the place versus the wisdom of the local people, which even though it comes to us reported as superstition and reported as perhaps animist interpretation because they mention evil spirits, the wisdom of the local people in describing what is really the peril of any who climb Kilimanjaro, and it's not so much the technical difficulty because there's a very easy route up the mountain which you'll be seeing, but it's the effect of altitude And when you look at some of the things which the local people described, it seems to me that although we claim we climbed it first, they are describing a good bit of what happens to you when you climb mountains. So I'm not so sure that we know who climbed it first. I'll move back to the projector.
Jonathan, there's a story too about why a lion found between Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya.
It's not true.
Not true?
No.
Oh. Yeah,
tell it.
Nice story.
Tell it anyway. What is it?
When they were dividing it up, they thought that each queen had to have a mountain. So
right.
One to the German and one to the British.
The Kaiser said to the British queen, "You've got two snowy mountains in Africa. I only have one."
Yeah.
So he gave it. The queen gave it to Tanzania. Yeah. But my sources say that that's a delightful story, but not true. This. Climb of Kilimanjaro has characters in it. There are the Japanese, the Americans, the French, and the Tanzanians. You've just seen us some Tanzanians. They aren't the ones who climbed it, but they can stand in for the Tanzanians in the story. This is the other American who climbed it that day. His name is Dave. He'd been in the Peace Corps in the Southeast Asian country of Sabah for a long time. He'd also taught in China. The Japanese character in the play is this man. His name is Hori. He was a little short on the language of the area for tourists, which is English, but he had a lot of film with him. And he seemed to be doing very well. He was on a small motorcycle, and he was driving the length of Africa from north to south, and he stopped off to climb Kilimanjaro. Now, for the French characters in this story of climbing Kilimanjaro, I have to do this, because the French characters, their role happens largely at night for six of them, and for the other two French characters, they were in prison the whole time the story took place, so I don't have any pictures of them. You'll find out. When you start at the gate. This is the Kilimanjaro National Park at Marangu. It's the entrance to the park. It's the place where most tourist climbers go from. And you'll see the stages there. Mandara is the first set of huts. And although it's only 3 hours away, and those are meters in the third column, and then the zones on the right, although it's only 3 hours away, the recommendation is that be your first day's walk. Because what they want you to do is adapt to altitude and not get altitude sickness, which I said was the biggest danger. The second place, Horombo, is 5 hours from Mandara, and that's recommended as your second day. And by that time, people are known to get sick, although it's only 3,700 meters. That's about 13,000 feet. Kibo is at the base of the summit, the part of the mountain that looks like a summit. And at Kibo already, you're higher than any mountain in the lower 48. Gilman's Point is the edge of the crater when you get to the top of the rim, and you're only 200 meters short of the top in altitude, but it's another hour and a half from Gilman's to Uhuru Peak. So you leave Mandara or Marangu, and this is what you see. The day I did it, I happened to be alone at this point. And I remember as I went up this path, the intense feeling of sort of exhilaration of having some spare time, having this mountain, and being able to go up that path, in whatever manner you like. There was a group who had left the day before, and I had the okay from the people at the gate that I could catch them. If I could catch them, I could leave. So I went out under that understanding, because you can only climb it as a group. In the forest, we mentioned the cloud forest. I met some people coming down. What they are is Tanzanian porters carrying supplies up and down the mountain, because it's quite possible to climb Kilimanjaro in great luxury. You can eat steak at the Horombo camp, if you like, and they'll carry it up for you. All it takes is a little money. You can pay $1,000 or $2,000 to climb the mountain and eat steak as you go.
How much does it cost if you just want to eat at lower altitude?
Well, that was my question too. And when I got there, I got by at about $100. You basically have to pay $100 to get to climb the mountain to the National Park Service there at the gate. Beyond that, they want you to use their, I think you have to hire a porter. Even if you're not going to use it, you have to pay for one. So it costs you about $100. And you can bring whatever food you want. The 3-hour point that was mentioned there, this is called Mandara. It's at an altitude of about 9,000 feet. So it's about the same height as the tops of the mountains around here. And you can see that it's still forest. So you can see the effect of the mountains, of the equator being in the tropics on that high altitude. This is midday and it's deserted. As you climb, the forests disappear, you get into that zone of moorland, and you start seeing these strange plants, and I can never remember what they're called. Does anybody know? Excuse me? I don't think so. You got a peculiar name. But you can find them in any fairly warm climate at high altitude, but only in that situation. They have they're a big feature for biologists or botanists on the mountains. Now, we said about fire and ice. This is an example of as far as the fire got. That's a volcanic vent. And it makes a roof. And I went over and had a look at it. It was beside the path, not too far off. And inside was a beautiful cave area with dry plants on the floor. Beautiful place to spend the night. Now we're up at about 13,000 feet. This is the end of what is normally the second day's climb. These are the Horombo huts. They were built by the Norwegian government as a foreign aid project for Tanzania, so that all the Norwegian tourists had a place to stay, I suppose. And you see there one of the porters, and he's got a wicker basket, and in it is firewood. There's no firewood, so the firewood gets carried up to this 13,000 foot altitude on the backs of people. This is at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And with the cloud around, it was a pretty eerie feeling. Slept in those houses, and the next morning, here's the scene, again at the same place, 13,000 feet. And you have the sense for the first time of being in a low-flying or a high-flying aircraft, not as high as an airliner, of course, but there's nothing around you. There's no other mountains to look at. All you see is the clouds covering the plain. And somewhere out there is the Serengeti and Gorongoro and all those places you read about. And here are the Tanzanian guides and porters for whom the mountain is just everyday life. They're the ones who work on it. They're the ones who you have to pay to go onto it. They're all stretching and getting ready for the day. If you've got questions, please interrupt. From this point on, there was a group of 8 in which we had the Japanese, the American, and the French. 8 people who had been arranged by the YMCA to go up to the top, and I joined them. And as I say, there was 1 American, 1 Japanese, and 6 French people already in that group. You head out from... The Tanzanians will come into it. And from that camp at Horombo, and you see the summit quite early in the piece. And this is where that local wisdom starts to make some sense. You see it now, first thing in the morning, and you keep seeing it all day, and it never seems to get any closer. It recedes in front of you. Probably 4 hours later, it looks like this. And you see the moorland getting different, a little bit different, less green, more dry, and starting to peter out. Yeah, volcanic rocks. And there's a glacier here on the highest point.
from where we stand now, it looks like the highest point. That's called the Retzo Glacier, and the man who eventually climbed it for the first time 103 years before this picture was taken in 1889, he named it after his geography professor at the University of Leipzig. So that's called the Retzo Glacier, and he actually made it to the top. He and his Swiss guide friend made it to the top by ice climbing along that glacier. It was quite a bit larger than it was than it is now. I mentioned Mawenzi in the chart on the board. This is Mawenzi. It's off to your right, to the north, as you walk towards the cone of Kibo. And you can see it looks quite a bit different. It's all fissured, doesn't have an ice cap. It's much steeper, much harder to climb. And it's a much newer volcanic feature than the actual top. And local legend has it that the fire god, when he was about to die on the top, carried his fire over to here, and this one kept burning. And that coincides with the geological record that this is a much more recent volcano.
How recent?
There's no sign of life now, so I think we're talking, you know, several thousand years. Some of the local design features. Still going, still receding, still ascending in front of you as you walk. But you can see very clearly the path made by all the porters and the foreigners who come. And you can also see right below my finger a sort of a mark. That's where, after you take this picture, that's where you'll be the next wee small hours of the morning. This is where the French people come into the story. That's the scree field that people have to negotiate as they try to get up to the top there. And that's today's main obstacle. If you don't speak about altitude sickness, the scree field is the part that all the tourist climbers talk about when they go to Kilimanjaro. Now, it wasn't always this easy. When Hans Mayer, the Swiss or the German geographer who was the first one to climb it, came in 1887, he reported down here in the saddle, about where my finger is, he reported 2 meter drifts of snow. And he was in July. This picture's taken in early October. He came back in 1889 and climbed it in almost the same time of year, the first week in October when this picture was taken. And he still reported considerable ice walls. But that first time in 1887, they got up to about this height, which he figured to be at about 5,000 meters, and they ran into a wall of ice that was, he said, 30 meters high, which is 100 feet high. The wall of ice is no longer there, obviously. But there's another wall there, which you find out about when you go and try to climb it.
What kind of temperature were you experiencing?
This is pretty much midday, and the temperature, I don't have any recollection what it would be. The air was pretty cold, but you could certainly hike in shirt sleeves. The sun was very strong. This saddle area here is at about 15,000 feet, that path in front of you there. Now, you might think this is a boring landscape, but there's natural beauty. You can see there Mawenzi, and it actually has snow. You can see in between the fingers of it, and you can see the slopes of a smaller cone on the saddle and the pieces of volcanic rock. And then suddenly there's something which doesn't belong there, and you notice it for a while and you go over and have a look. Well, here's where the French come in. Two Frenchmen flying this ultralight in October 1986 flew in from Kenya and thought they would perhaps, I don't know, fly over the top of Kilimanjaro and be the first people to do that in an ultralight. They landed on the saddle here at about 15,000 feet and started taking pictures and perhaps climbing to go higher, I don't know. The porters came over to them, and the porters are all Tanzanians, they're not Kenyans. They came over to them and they said, "What are you doing here? Where did you come from? Where is your authorization?" the two Frenchmen decided that they would try to give them the slip, and they tried to take off on this volcanic dust. The front wheel didn't like it and dug into this to the dust. The plane flipped over on its back, cracking its propeller, and the porters ran after it and grabbed them again and made a citizen's arrest and carried them down to Moshi and put them in prison. But not before the two Frenchmen had time to write a note or and make a radio call to their friend. And this, here's a little note in French, and it says, Didi, don't be upset. The police, have taken us down to Moshi, and if you get here, start putting the plane back together, and we'll come back as quick as we can from Moshi. Alexis. So this note was pinned to the seat. And we thought we'd try it out, you know, in case it might help us to, you know, do our business the next morning a little easier. You can see the broken propeller there. The fuel tank was gone. I think Tanzanians took the fuel tank off it to make sure it didn't go anywhere. But it didn't look too lively. So late in that day, as one walks from Horombo to Kibo, which is the hut at the last hut, the one that's higher than any mountain in the lower 48 already, at 4,700 meters, about 16,000 feet. This is your view. You're looking back, getting up to almost the height of Mawenzi. You can see the evening clouds coming up from the plain and covering the saddle. You can see part of an old volcanic cone there, volcanic rock. And there's the Kibo hut, where you have the pleasure of spending the night. And personal note on this, it was terribly cold there, and you were a little worried if you'd be warm. Got into my sleeping bag and I got warm, but not until I had had some supper. And at 16,000 feet, I found out that instant soup doesn't cook very well, but I knew that a lot of energy would be useful the next day, so I forced myself to really, you know, eat some of this soup. And I don't know what it was, but it started coming back at me very soon thereafter from, you know, the way things go in the mountains, from what happens to your food after you've eaten it. It happens here at Holden, too. And it was a very unpleasant night. We were to get up at 12 o'clock, midnight, and be ready to go at 12:30. And what happened at 12:30 was Dave, the other American, and I got up and felt real fit and wanted to start out. But we sort of made motions to go, and the Tanzanian guides, there were two assigned to our party, they said, no, absolutely not, you wait. And when the six French people and the Japanese man had come out, they lined us up, one after the other, they put a guide at the beginning, a guide at the end, and the nine of us in between, and they started out. This is all at 12:30, right there in front of that house, in the dark, in the cold, at 16,000 feet. And it's a strange sensation. I wondered why we had to walk like that, and I had really sort of some bad thoughts about how this wasn't the way to climb a mountain. But they kept us in single file, like a prisoner's gang, and off we marched towards the scree slope. We had gone about 20 minutes, and we found out why the arrangement was the way it was. Because at the first break, one of our party felt ill. They didn't stop and ask him very many questions. The last of the guides grabbed him by the scruff of the neck, picked him up, and walked him back to Kibo, and caught up with us again. We kept climbing, and by the time we took our next break, the guy who had gone down with the sick man was back with us, and another one was sick. They picked him up by the scruff of the neck, took him back to Kibo, and caught up with us again. This happened virtually in the first 3 hours. We got rid of three members of the party this way. And the second guide, his job was to take people back. I guess they knew that's what would happen to these nine Westerners, or the eight Westerners and one Japanese who was there, and they were ready for it. So by the time the sun came up, we had been going about 6 hours, and I took a picture of Mawenzi. And I think the picture isn't clear because I was shaking. What I found out, partly because of that chain gang and the way we had to walk, at the pace of the whole party, at a very slow pace. If you're somebody who dresses light when you hike to get warm from your energy, from your exercise, it's not a good idea when you get up to that altitude, and I only discovered this the hard way. We weren't going fast enough to get warm, but what I think happens is, if you go fast enough to get warm, you'll get sick. So I was discovering that the hard way, and by sunup, I was quite cold, and you know, seriously thinking this wasn't really such a great idea what I was doing. I took the same picture a little bit later from the top, the rim of the caldera, and you can see the clouds still flowing down from the north, surrounding Mawenzi as if it's a ship. And right there you're at about 18,000 something feet, and you're done with the scree field. And I should say with the scree field that it's frozen. That's why you start at midnight, because it's frozen. Even though there's hardly any water to speak of in the pumice, it's frozen or as solid as it gets, so the climbing of it is that much easier in the night. So you go up the zigzags during the night like that. Taken from virtually the same spot, this is looking north. Now, it's at about 18,000 feet, as I said. My feelings at this point were really just sort of a lack of joy. you know, you should have probably been happy, but I think that that's the part of the altitude sickness that was getting me. And the six of us who were still in the group at this point pretty much sat there like bumps on a log and didn't do very much. The last picture was looking to the north. This picture is looking back to the west, again at Mawenzi, but pointing the camera a bit further down. And if you look closely, you can see the things we've been talking about. There's Kibo Hut. So all you've done for your night's work is gone from there to here. And it's not a huge altitude. It's from 16,000 to 19,000, roughly, or a little bit less. But it's the altitude that makes the difference, and the scree, the volcanic scree, which shifts backwards as you step on it, isn't real friendly as a surface. The ultralight flying machine is sitting somewhere about here, I think, so you can get your bearings there. And the hike to Kilimanjaro starts way down here in the lowlands. So basically what you've been doing is a 35-mile walk from there along the flanks of Mawenzi. Horombo, the place where the guys were stretching in the early morning, is about here where it gets darker. There's where the third night is usually spent there. And then you do this in the early morning. This is the view from the same spot at the edge of the crater. It's called Gilman's Point, the place where you sort of drag yourself up to at first light, looking into the caldera, into what's left of the crater of Kilimanjaro, and you can see some glaciers that are still there. Up on the upper left-hand side is the highest point in Africa, Uhuru Peak. And this is the spot that you have to try to go to. It's the spot where you can say you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. As we sat there at Gilman's, our Tanzanian guide, his name was Hapigor Ngari, he looked at us in a funny way, and I couldn't tell what he was thinking. But I think what he was thinking was, I hope they all feel so bad that none of them want to go onto Uhuru Peak. Because Uhuru there is 5 miles away. This picture's taken from a bit closer to it. And it takes another hour and a half. And it's at the highest altitude, of course, on the mountain. And it adds a lot to his job. After we lay around for a while, three of us decided to go on. And Happy Gore was a little bit upset, but he went with us because it was part of the deal.
How big is the glacier there?
That would be probably, something like a 5-story building, 6-story building, 7-story building, I don't know. It's thick. But the glaciation up there is much, much less than it used to be. And what they figure is that the glaciers have receded ever since what was called the Little Ice Age. Europe experienced a cold period from 1400 to 1700. And since that time, our weather's been getting warmer. And Mayer, who was up there in 1887, succeeded in 1889 and went back in 1899, noted quite a bit of recession of the glaciers in that period. And he predicted there wouldn't be any ice left at all within 30 years if it kept going the way he described it. But as you can see, there's still some around. And the geologists reckon that there actually have been periods when Kilimanjaro has been ice-free for a long time. So it's not necessarily connected with what we call global warming. It's been happening since the end of the last century, if not before. This is Hori, the Japanese. And his part in this story is that he was one of the three who decided to go on to Uhuru. Sitting behind him is Happy Gore, not looking too happy. And the problem with Hori here is that soon after we left Gilman's, he started to vomit. The three French people who were left, you might have figured out that the three people who were taken back in the middle of the night were French. There were three French people left in the group at Gilman's, and they stayed there, didn't go on. But Hori, Dave the Peace Corps man, and myself went on with Happy Gore to see the top. And about 20 minutes up the trail, Hori started tossing his cookies. And he did it until he didn't have any cookies left. And then he kept doing it. And it was really sort of painful to watch. But what was even more amazing was he refused to stop. He kept walking and walking. At times he was bent over, doubled over, his face almost on the ground, sort of heaving as he walked. And it was a picture of Japanese determination, if I can be stereotypical, that this man refused to say no, he was going to make it to the top of Kilimanjaro. But we're taking a break here. And he's probably trying to decide how he feels. Looking back, this is Gilman's, where those earlier pictures from the top were taken. This is where you sort of clamber out from the volcanic scree and rest at about 18,000 something feet. And then you walk towards Uhuru along this rim, and you've got the caldera to your right. Meyer described that caldera in 1889 as full of ice and snow. He got into it through a breach, which I think might be somewhere around there. It's hard to tell anymore, but a breach in what he described as 60 meter tall glaciers, which at that time were going down the southwest side of the mountain. I showed you a little bit of the southwest snow cap. He found a breach and came in that way. Earlier you saw these steps at a better angle, those huge steps of ice coming down from Gilman's. He described those as marching right into the middle of the caldera. So you can see that although it's spectacular, it was a lot more spectacular 100 years ago, I guess. Meyer also described fields of 1 meter and 2 meter high icicles, sort of inverted icicles, created by the sun. I think they're called, if they're not sun cups, they're something like it, where the sun melts this ice differently. But actually, the scientists say that the ice melts very little at this altitude from the sun, because the snow is so white, it reflects most of the sun. And the way that these glaciers are being melted is by the volcanic rock absorbing the heat of the sun and cooking the glacier from underneath and undermining it, and then pieces of the glacier fall down, and that's the way they're beating the glacier back up the mountain, or back down the mountain. So we made it to the top, and as you can see, Happy Gore is very excited. He found a bottle of Johnny Walker Red there, which was no longer serviceable, but he pretended like it was. There's a plaque in the foreground which talks about Tanganyika and the Torch of Liberty and how a Tanzanian army troop planted the flag here on such and such a day in 1960 when Tanzania became independent. There's various other things people have left to show they've been there. But this is the summit, and so you can see it's not exactly a point on which very few people can stand. It's a big flat place, sort of just a bump on the edge of the crater wall. The green plastic bag is from a place where my wife worked in Geneva at the time. I thought I might get some money from the shop if they saw one of their bags on top of Kilimanjaro, but didn't work. There's no book to sign. The Tanzanian lies down when he gets to the top. The Westerner stands up and has his picture taken. Those are those big glaciers left. They're called, the one below me is called the Furtwängler Glacier, another good Tanzanian name. Looking off towards the west. And far in the northwest, you can see, not on this slide, but when you're there, on good days, you can see Mount Kenya, which also has snow on the top and is almost as high. It was really cold. There was no heat from the sun. There was no heat from your body. I don't know what it was, minus 10? It wasn't windy. We had great weather. But it was just bone-chilling cold. And like I say, I had never warmed up since the episode with the chain gang in the morning. Here we are heading back. And look at those walls of ice on the right. I mean, those have got to be 100 feet, 120 feet tall, going down the south slope of the mountain. Some of you have heard of Reinhard Messner, the Austrian climber who does everything by himself, has climbed everything over 8,000 meters in the world. He climbed this southern wall right up over the ice glaciers, and it's very difficult mountaineering if you do it from that side. That block of glacier, all that's left of a glacier, is about the size of Koinonea and this room, this Koinonea and the village center put together. But you can't really tell from this picture. You can see that blob. It's just a little white speck on the top of the mountain from down on the plain on a clear day. And again, you're at 19,300 feet here. When you're going down, you have to face the scree field again, but by this time it's not frozen anymore. The camera here is pointed about 45 degrees down into the clouds. That little speck is my friend Dave, who's basically running and skiing down the scree. And you feel guilty because you're destroying all these zigzags which helped you so much during the morning. But to go down, you just go straight. It's sort of skiing on your boots, crashing your way down. And that's what you look at most of the time. Then you get the same views again of Mawenzi, the beautiful smaller peak at 17,000 something. You get back into the zone of tundra. Excuse me?
Is that something growing or is that plumes?
Those are little shrubs. Yep. And you get back down to where you covered on the first or second day, and you see an old cone of a volcano there, and beyond it you see the lowlands where the rest of Africa continues as normal. And you have a real sense of stepping off of an island onto something different, which is like the sea around you.
How long did it take you to get down there,
though? It took about, well, the morning that we walked as a chain gang, we went to the top, came back, and spent the night again at that place where the porters were stretching at 9,000 feet. And then the next morning we were back at the bottom by noon. They recommend that you take 5 days to do it because of the dangers of pulmonary edema as the main terror of altitude sickness. A fair number of people get sick, and a lot of people don't get past that second set of huts at, I guess it's 13,000 feet. A lot of people are sick there already and just hang around and have to go back, no matter how much money they paid. That's the end of the show.